Our next speaker is Troy Evans, and he's going to share a unique history that might surprise you. As a speaker and author who was born in Phoenix, Arizona, he had a relatively uneventful life, a loving family. He played sports, got a car when he was turned 16. He married out of high school and had a son. He earned two college degrees, graduating with the highest academic honors available, and funded his entire college career through academic scholarships. In short, this sounds like an all-American boy who made good. Troy has made good, but not before he made bad. Very bad. I will let him tell his story, and please welcome Troy Evans.
I want you to know that it's both my honor and my privilege to be here sharing with you today. Over the next 40, 45 minutes or so as I'm up here speaking, it looks like we're going to have a little extra time. So over this period of time while I'm speaking, if I say something that generates a question in your mind, or if I say something that you would like me to expand on, or if I say something that you would like to offer a comment on, I would ask you, please commit that to memory, or better yet, write it down on a piece of paper for, as I said, it's going to be my intention to open it up for a couple of questions, so please keep that in mind while I'm speaking. I would ask that you all please take a close look at this face. This is the face of a college graduate. This is the face, as Ron just told you, of a college graduate who earned both of his degrees with the highest academic honors available. This is the face of a kind man, a trustworthy man, a man of his word. Please take a look at this face. Now look at this face. This is the face of a man who on March 20th, 1992, walked into the First Tier National Bank, brandished a semi-automatic pistol, and demanded all the 20s, 50s, and 100s. This would be the first of five armed bank robberies I would commit over a six-month crime spree when I was 28 years old. Please take a look at this face. Both these faces are mine. The transformation between the two, the transformation from a suicidal, drug-induced bank robber to what you see standing before you today took place gradually over 7.5 years within the confines of a federal penitentiary. How did I come to the point of robbing banks? How did I come to the point in my life where I was willing to stick a gun in somebody's face and demand their money? Looking back now, I can directly link my crimes and my incarceration to the decisions I made as a teenager, and in particular, my decision to experiment with drugs. Just occasionally, just every once in a while, a little marijuana use on the weekend, no big deal, I could handle it. But the problem was, and I'm here to tell you, it seemed like it happened overnight, in the course of about a year and a half, drugs became the single most important thing in my life. Every action I took, every thought that went through my mind revolved around acquiring or using drugs. I stole from my family, I broke into cars, I broke into houses, I did whatever I had to do to feed my addiction. By the time I eked my way out of high school with C's and D's, there was literally not a drug on the street that I hadn't tried, and there were several that I used on a regular basis. And just so you don't think this happens to only bad kids or at-risk kids or kids from broken homes or kids from the wrong neighborhood, I was a star athlete and an honor roll student when I began experimenting with drugs. I had the right morals, the right values, the right work ethic put before me. My parents were 18 years old when I was born. My dad was a full-time student at the University of Arizona, and he worked full-time to support his newborn son. After graduating from U of A, he rose through the ranks of Motorola to become vice president and would later go on to become president of Contrail and TRW. So as I said, I had the right morals, the right values, the right work ethic put before me, but again, the drugs proved to be much stronger than that. After graduating from high school, I turned to the only occupation I could that could feed a habit such as mine. I dealt drugs. 2 years out of high school, I met a girl who was foolish enough, stupid enough to marry me, and we had a son. Bringing a child into this world is supposed to be a beautiful thing. For me, it wasn't a beautiful thing. What I was doing was bringing somebody into this world that I would later hurt, that I would later discard, that I would later add to the long list of those that were devastated by my addiction. For 4 years, my wife put up with my lying, my cheating, and my using ways, and she divorced me and took custody of my son. I didn't think there was a downhill still left in my life, but that gutter is very, very deep. By the time I left my ex-wife and my son behind in that small Midwestern town, there was literally not one waking moment during the day that I wasn't high on something. I couldn't even perform the most fundamental of tasks, let alone hold any type of a job. So for me, turning to bank robbery was a natural. For me, it was a win-win situation. Either I was going to go into that institution and come out with enough money to feed my habit for another 30, 60 days, or the police were going to show up, and I was going to make them do something that I didn't have the guts to do myself. Suicide by police is what they call that today. November 12, 1992. November 12th of that same year I committed those string of armed bank robberies was that day the hardest day I ever had to face in my life. You see, that was the day I stood before a federal judge and was told I was going to spend the next 157 months, 13 years, 1 month behind the walls of a federal penitentiary. That was, to that day, the hardest day I ever had to face until the following day came. You see, that's the day I had to call my then 7-year-old son, Eric, and tell him that his dad wasn't going to be available to him for a very long time. A 7-year-old child, a third grader, cannot comprehend the span of 13 years. How could he possibly comprehend that? That was almost twice as long as he had been alive. All he wanted to know was whether he got to come spend summer vacation with me the next year, as had been the case the prior 3 years. No, Eric, you won't be coming to spend summer vacation with me next year. Well, how about the one after that, Dad? No, not that one either. Well, for sure the one after that, Daddy. Okay, for sure that one. No, Eric, not that one either. When will I be coming to spend summer vacation with you again, Dad? The one when you turn 18 years old. That's when you'll be coming to spend summer vacation with your dad. I wasn't going to be. My son lived in a very small Midwestern town. Everybody knew his business. Everybody knew his dad was a con, was a felon, was incarcerated. He was teased and tormented relentlessly. The first time I ever saw my son in the prison visiting room, I actually heard him before I saw him. I was in the little holding cell that they put you in after they strip search you before they let you out to see your visitors. And as I'm in this little holding cell, I got my hands on two steel bars and I got my face pressed between two other bars, and I could hear something on the other side of that door that I hadn't heard in a very long time. I could hear joy. I could hear happiness. I could hear women talking and laughing. I could hear kids playing. And over the sound of all this, I hear my 7-year-old son Eric's voice. I hear him asking a prison guard, if my dad can't spend the night in the hotel with me tonight, can I spend the night in here with him? And it hit me like a ton of bricks, despite everything my 7-year-old son had to go through to come into that institution, despite the clanging doors behind him, despite having to remove his belt and his shoes, despite having to walk through a metal detector and being patted down at 7 years old to make sure he wasn't smuggling contraband into the institution. Despite these things, I was still his daddy. He didn't care where I was or what I had done. And that first time I saw him in that prison visiting room, I dropped to my knees and I told him, thank you for still loving me. Thanks for still believing in me. That phone call to my son and that visiting room scene brought me to a very, very sick realization. But what it brought me to realize is that drugs have become more important to me than the single most important person in my life. It was that simple. And it also brought me to the realization that I was breaking the chain. I was breaking the chain of my great-grandfather being there for my grandfather being there for my dad being there for me. I wasn't going to be there for my son. The awakening, what I quote call the awakening, the time in my life where I decided I had to get off of that train I had been riding the last 15 years, the time in my life where I decided I couldn't keep doing things the way I had been doing them, this quote awakening, took place about 6 months into my incarceration, and it was fueled by three things. The first thing that fueled this awakening of mine was the dead time in prison. It literally hangs in the air. I would sit in the common areas, and I would watch guys play cards, play dominoes, and watch TV for 12, 14, 16 hours a day, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Some of these guys doing this for 5, 10, 15 years at a time. I would look at this, and I'd think to myself, is this how these guys are going to make a living when they get out of here? I couldn't fathom spending all that time in that fashion. And the second thing that fueled this awakening of mine was, of course, my son. I discovered that not only was it possible, but that I had the responsibility to influence my far-off son in a positive way. And the third thing that fueled this awakening of mine is something that my dad used to say when I was a kid growing up, something that I lost track of during my teens and early 20s, but something that I came to lean on and believe in and rely on during those years of incarceration. And what my dad used to say is this: anything in this life which is worthwhile, which is really, really worthwhile, is never easy. And you see, I had always taken the easy road. The easy road is the drug use, the lying, the stealing, the cheating. Anybody can do those things. It doesn't take a special individual, man, woman, boy, or girl to do that. Anybody can do those things. That's the easy road. The more difficult road is a road of self-respect, a road of believing in yourself, a road of oftentimes standing over here when it seems like you're all alone and everybody else is going in a different direction or doing something else, but knowing in your head and in your heart what you're doing is the right thing. That's oftentimes a more difficult road. But that's a road to a bright future. That's a road to prosperity. That's a road to success. So I have this awakening, right? For me, it's going to be education. Education's what I'm going to sink my teeth into. Education is going to be the means in which I take a very negative situation and make it as positive as I possibly can. But just because I have this grand idea on this grand scale, I still have only the obstacles that prison can put before you. Within the Federal Bureau of Prisons, gangs run the prisons. As the gangs go, so go the prisons. The Aryan Brotherhood, the Mexican Mafia, the Bloods, the Crips, they dictate what happens behind the walls of a federal penitentiary. Because I happened to be arrested, because I happened to fall in Denver, Colorado, at that very same time the new Supermax facility was opening up in Florence, Colorado. Same facility that held Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, John Gotti, Manuel Noriega, the Unabomber, Jeffrey Dahmer for a short time. Well, because this new facility was opening up, they needed bodies, so that's where I was sent. And because I was sent to this complex in Florence, that put me 30 miles from home, 30 miles from my family, my friends, my loved ones. This wasn't the norm. Most of the guys I was locked up with came from throughout the country, New York, Texas, California, Utah. Well, because I was so close to home, I got visits. Every single weekend, somebody came to see me, either a family member or a friend. Again, this wasn't the norm. Most of these guys were lucky if they got one visit, very lucky if they got one visit a year. When these gang members discovered the frequency of my visits, they approached me and they told me that I was going to smuggle drugs into the prison through the visiting room using my family and my friends as mules, and they told me that I was going to do this or that they were going to kill me. And I'll get back to these gang members in a minute, but first I need to give you an idea of the kind of people I was locked in a cage with. I want to tell you a story about a guy named Charlie Dotson. Good guy as far as a con goes, very respectful of others, never got in anybody's way. Center fielder on my prison softball team. Charlie and I worked in Unicor Federal Prison Industries. Our particular facility built furniture. I worked upstairs in the business office as an accountant. Charlie worked downstairs on the floor actually assembling the furniture. One day I walked over to the copier, and as my copy was running, I looked through a big plate glass window and I leaned against this big plate glass window and I saw on the assembly floor below me lay my friend Charlie Dotson, a 3-foot pool of blood surrounding his head and another inmate standing over him with a 4-foot oak table leg repeatedly bringing it down on Charlie's head, although it was obvious Charlie had been dead for some time. I opened my mouth to scream, "Stop! Somebody stop what's happening." No words came out. 50 to 60 other inmates stood in a circle where this was taking place. Just like me, no words came out of their mouth. They didn't try to stop what was happening. They didn't go to get anybody to stop what was happening. You see, in prison, you mind your own business or that'll be you on the floor the next day. You know what Charlie Dotson lost his life over that day? This is what he lost his life over. A 69-cent Papermate pen. That other inmate accused Charlie of walking by his workstation, picking a 69-cent pen up off of his desk, thus disrespecting him, thus giving him the right to take Charlie's life. Charlie Dotson broke the laws of our society. He deserved to be incarcerated, but he didn't deserve to lose his life over a 69-cent pen, and his wife of 8 years and his 6-year-old daughter didn't deserve to lose their husband and their father over a 69-cent pen. And if that story isn't horrific enough, Charlie was going home in 4 weeks. He had served his 3-year sentence and was going home in less than a month. There were times that I was involved in racial riots within the institution, not by choice. One of these lasted for 2.5 days. For 2.5 days, the inmates had complete run of the institution. The guards abandoned the institution and took up a perimeter stance with automatic weapons. Their only concern was that nobody got over those fences. For 2.5 days, while the inmates had run of the institution, I'm a big guy. I like to think I can take care of myself, but I'm not too proud to tell you that I spent those 2.5 days hunkered behind a little 4-foot steel locker in my cell, praying every time that cell door was swung open that they didn't come a little further to see if anybody was in there hiding. You see, over those 2.5 days, people were pulled out of their cell, they were beaten, they were stabbed, and they were killed for one reason and one reason only, because of the color of their skin. There were times that racial tensions were so high, you literally couldn't go to sleep by yourself. You had to sleep in shifts. I would sleep up on a bunk for a couple hours while guys would play cards at the foot of my bed. After my turn was up, we would rotate, and one of them would go up and get some sleep. You see, during these times of high tension, you didn't dare go to sleep either day or night by yourself because they'd come in and stab you while you were sleeping. So these gang members, right, I've had several altercations with them, and up to this point, I've told them I'm not going to do it. But the day finally comes where I have to make a decision. Three of them come in on me in my prison cell, and they're carrying with them what they kill each other with in prison. The first one is carrying one of these, a toothbrush, a simple everyday toothbrush. They take one end of it and they file it down on the concrete to a sharp point, and the other end they wrap in duct tape to use as a handle. That's what the first one's carrying. The second one is carrying one of these, pork chop bone. Looks pretty harmless on your plate at the end of a meal, but again, they take the long part of the bone and they file it down on the concrete to a sharp point, and the large part of the bone fits nicely into the palm of your hand. They come up behind one another and they stab each other in the artery of the neck with these. That's what the second one's carrying. And the third one is carrying one of these, a 16-penny nail driven through a piece of a broom handle. So these three guys come into my cell carrying these things, and they tell me it's time to make a decision, Evans. Are you going to do this or aren't you? Was I scared? Yeah, I was scared. I was terrified. The first thing that came to my mind is, I'll do it. I'll do whatever you say. Just please, please put those things away. But then something stronger than my fear overcame me. I thought about my son and how he was committed to me no matter where I was. And I thought about my family and how I had always sacrificed them, how I had always put myself first and them second. And I don't know where the strength came from, because I can tell you I didn't feel very strong at that moment. But from somewhere inside of me came the words, I'm not going to do it. You're going to have to do what you came to do. What happened next? Well, I believe, as a matter of fact, I know things happen for a reason. A jingle of keys can be heard coming down the corridor. A guard's on his way. When they hear this, they take their shanks and they throw them underneath my mattress. You're only allowed to have two inmates in the cell at a time, so when he comes to my cell and he sees them in there, he sticks his head in and he says, Evans, what are these guys doing in here? I said, they're not doing a thing. We're just visiting. They're not doing anything. He orders them out. 5 minutes later, I gathered up their shanks and I took them back to him one at a time and I handed them to him and I told him, I think you guys forgot something. They never bothered me again. Whether it was because I didn't tell that guard what they were doing in my cell that day, or whether it was because they could see in my eye that I was no longer going to take that easy road, that they were going to have to do whatever it was that they came to do, whatever the reason, I was never bothered again. July 16, 1997, fast forward 4.5 years. I've been incarcerated for 4.5 years up to this day. And there's really nothing special about this day. I'm just going through my everyday prison routine when again a guard sticks his head in my cell and he says, Evans, get down to your counselor's office. He wants to see you immediately. I shuffle down to my counselor's office and he tells me, sit down. I just got a phone call on you from a guy in Auburn, Alabama, a scholarship committee chairman with a national association. They're interested in helping you with your schooling. And then it all came back to me. You see, the prior 6 weeks to that day that I was called into my counselor's office, the prior 6 weeks to that day, I spent every single free minute I had, 14, 16, sometimes 18 hours a day, sitting at my tiny little prison desk in my tiny little prison cell, filling out applications, writing essays, begging, pleading, and selling myself to absolutely every private scholarship across the country that I even remotely qualified for. But I was a con. I was a felon. Nobody wanted to take a chance on me. Every day at mail call, I got a stack of rejection letters this high every single day saying thanks, but no thanks. Congress had voted away Pell Grants for the incarcerated. I was 2 years into my first degree when it looked like my dream of earning a college degree, my dream of taking a negative situation and making it as positive as I could, just wasn't going to happen. 1 week after I was called to my counselor's office, I got a letter from that association and a check for one class, one single class. I took that class and I mailed them my report card. They sent me a check for two classes. I again mailed them my report card for those two classes, and it snowballed to the point where they were funding entire semesters. And the end result of that association's help was me walking out those doors of prison with two college degrees, both earned with a 4.0 GPA and placement on the dean's and president's list. So, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I'm rolling now, right? Things are going good. I'm making my mom and dad proud. I'm making my brother and sister proud. All of a sudden, my son Eric takes a renewed interest in his own education, and it becomes something that I can do with my son. He sends me through the mail all his papers with the little smiley faces and the little stars that the teacher puts on them. I send him my report cards, my term papers, my professor comments, and it becomes something I can do with my boy. When we talk on the phone, we rib each other when somebody doesn't do good on a test or an assignment. And it becomes something we can share. I'm not out there throwing a baseball with my boy, you know what I'm saying? But I'm doing something with him. Things are going good when a new warden comes to FCI Florence. This new warden immediately takes a dislike to me. He doesn't like the fact that I'm given extra library time. He doesn't like the fact that I'm given extra computer time. And he in particular does not like the fact that I'm being allowed to receive videotapes through the mail, which allow me to complete my courses by correspondence. So he tells me this is all coming to an end immediately. I turn to the association that's funded my schooling this entire time, and they happen to be very well politically connected. And over the next 6 weeks, 28 congressmen and senators call and write this warden demanding to know why I'm not being allowed to finish my degrees. He doesn't like this. He's not used to answering to anybody, but these are people he has to answer to, and he really doesn't like the fact that one of his inmates got this whole hornet's nest stirred up. So he calls me a risk to the security of the institution, puts me under investigation, and he throws me in the hole. The hole is a 6x9 foot cell. And in the 6x9 foot cell that you share with another individual is a steel bunk bed, a stainless steel toilet connected to a stainless steel sink, and a stainless steel shower, and one light bulb that stays on 24 hours a day. You have no idea what time of day or night it is. The only way you can gauge that is by your feedings, which come to you through a little slot in the door that flops open, and they slide a little food tray into you. Sometimes, and I mean only sometimes, you're let out for 1 hour a day to pace back and forth in what looks like a little dog kennel. The guys that I'm in the hole with are the troublemakers of the institution. Many of them probably mentally shouldn't even be in a traditional prison setting. They scream and yell and beat and kick on the doors 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's constant chaos. You can't get any sleep. 60 days I'm in this setting. I'm getting skinny. I'm getting pale. I read the same book 7 times. That's all I had to do. Up to that point, I had always believed that things happened for a reason, that I could learn from any situation I was put in. But I got to tell you, as this 60th day approaches and I'm still in this hole, I'm thinking to myself, why is this happening to you, Troy? All you're trying to do is better yourself. All you're trying to do is get a degree. All you're trying to do is give yourself a chance to succeed when you're released from here. Why is this happening to you? And then the only thing that could have made that situation any worse happens. They tell me they're transferring me to FCI Inglewood, the oldest, nastiest prison within the Federal Bureau of Prisons, built in 1939. It looks like something out of a medieval movie. When I get to FCI Inglewood, I discover that the conditions are even worse because one of the housing units is closed down for asbestos removal. When I get to the housing unit that I'm assigned to, I discover that within that housing unit is a common area called a pod. And in this pod that 150 guys share, it's probably about a quarter of the size of the room that we're in today. In this little area that 150 guys share are 4 sinks, 4 toilets, 3 showers, and a microwave oven. So you got guys taking a shower here, you got guys brushing their teeth here, you got guys using the restroom here, and you got guys lined up to heat up food in a microwave oven, all in this little tiny area. And don't think that there's stalls between any of these things. Everything, I mean everything's done out in the wide open. Picture all those different activities taking place in this little area. So I get to this place, I look at these conditions, and I'm thinking to myself, there is absolutely no way I can spend the next 5 years here. Again, I'm thinking to myself, why is this happening to you? All you're trying to do is earn a degree. All you're trying to do is better yourself. All you're trying to do is give yourself a chance to succeed when you're released. Why is this happening? Well, things do happen for a reason. I'm at FCI Inglewood for less than 3 months when I hear my name over the intercom. Evans number 24291-013. Report to the records office immediately. I go down to the records office and the lady tells me, shut the door and sit down. I would later discover that FCI Inglewood is the only institution in the entire Federal Bureau of Prisons the only institution in this entire country, over 200 institutions nationwide, the only one that has this policy. They automatically review the sentence computation of everybody who's transferred into their facility via another facility. She tells me, shut the door and sit down. I just got off the phone with the regional office. We went over your sentence computation. There's been a mistake. You shouldn't have been sentenced to 13 years. You should have only been sentenced to 8. You're going home in 10 days. If that warden had not taken a dislike to me, if I had not been thrown in the hole, and if I had not been transferred to FCI Inglewood, I would have spent an additional 5 years in federal prison. I was released in December of 1999, a little over 7 years ago. Things happen for a reason. And what I want to share with you now is four things that I learned over those 7.5 years of being locked in a cage. Four central truths that I believe in my heart to be the most important things in my life, and in my humble opinion, just my humble opinion, should be the most important things in the lives of everybody in this room today. And the first thing I learned was the value of time. Time is our most valuable commodity, bar none. Time is the most valuable thing we own, yet it is the thing we're often most wasteful with. We can't recycle it, we can't regenerate it, we can't rejuvenate it. Once it's gone, it's gone. And I became amazed what could be accomplished over short spans of time and over longer spans of time when I had set goals and agendas in front of me that I was constantly striving towards. And I'm not saying you shouldn't have time laying around watching TV, reading a book, going to the movies, going to the mall. I'm not saying that. It's all about balance in our lives, but we all need to have some kind of time management tool that assures us we're using our time as effectively as we possibly can. For me personally, the tool that I use, I have short and long-term goals in every single aspect of my life, every aspect within my business, relationships, material wants and needs, health-wise. And just by habit, I ask myself several times a day, is what you're doing right now, Troy, this very minute, getting you any closer to those goals? And if it's not, I change what I'm doing. It's that simple. I've heard my colleagues get up here and tell people, take out a piece of paper and write your goals down, and then put that piece of paper in away in a drawer, and then revisit it in 30 days and see if you're any closer to achieving those goals. Well, I say if your goals are living on a piece of paper in a drawer, you're not going after them. Mine are embossed and blazed in my mind. I'm constantly striving to achieve them. Time is the most valuable thing we own. Look at how you're using it. And just to help drive home that point of the importance of time, I want to share with you some different perspectives that I think will give you some new insight into the importance of time. I want to share with you something that I read on a piece of paper that was on a bulletin board in a lunchroom at a company in California I spoke at a few years ago. And what it said on this piece of paper was this: to realize the value of 1 year, ask a student who's failed a final exam. To realize the value of 1 month, ask a mother who's given birth to a premature baby. To realize the value of 1 week, ask the editor of a weekly newspaper. To realize the value of 1 day, one single day, ask the daily wage laborer who has 10 kids to feed. To realize the value of 1 hour, ask the lovers who are waiting to meet. To realize the value of 1 minute, one single minute, ask the person who's missed the bus, the plane, or the train. To realize the value of 1 second, ask the person who survived an accident. And to realize the value of a millisecond, one single millisecond, ask the person who won a silver medal in the Olympics. Time is the most valuable thing we own. Look at how you're using it. And just as importantly, spend a great amount of that time with the loved ones in your life, which brings me to the second thing that I learned over those 7.5 years. There's absolutely nothing more important than the loved ones in our life. Nothing. And I am in particular talking about the people in our everyday lives who we assume are always going to be there. The people who at the end of the day get a peck on the cheek and then we go plop down on the couch or get involved in other activities. They get that same peck on the cheek as we walk out the door in the morning. The people we assume are always going to be there, I'm here to tell you they're not always going to be there. And I was amazed how important those people were to me when they were taken away from me. Let these people know you love them and let them know often. Don't have regrets later. Regrets later are mistakes made today. It's not what we have in our lives, but who. And we all need to ask ourselves, are we spending the least time with what's most important? Don't give the best hour of the day to your job. Give the best hour of the day to the loved ones in your life. And the third thing that I learned over these 7.5 years of being locked in a cage was faith. And I'm not necessarily talking religion here. If you're a religious person, that's fine. That's fantastic. I'm talking about faith in something other than yourself. Faith that you're not alone. Faith that things happen in our lives for a reason, both good and bad. There was a reason I went to prison. Otherwise, I'd be dead. No doubt in my mind. I'm one of the few people that can make the statement that the worst thing that ever happened in my life, the absolute worst thing that ever happened to me, being sent to a federal prison, is at the same time the very best thing that ever happened to me. It literally saved my life. There was a reason those Jingle of Keys came down the corridor. When they did, there were bigger things in store for me. There was a reason I got those scholarships. I was busting my behind. Faith that things happen in our lives for a reason, both good and bad. And we're all masters, me included, at seeing how the good things that come into our lives can make us better people, how we can grow, become stronger, prosper from the good things, the promotions, the bonuses, the raises, the awards, the accolades. We're all masters at seeing how those can make us better people. But where we often struggle is with the bad things that come into our lives, the tragedies that take place in our lives, and seeing how they can make us better, stronger people. And I get up here and I talk about this 60, 70 times a year. Faith that things happen in our lives for a reason, yet I was reminded of it in my own life a little over 4.5 years ago. My first indication that something was wrong was as I put the key in the front door of my house. As I swung open the front door upon returning from the office, I saw that the contents of my hallway closet were strewn up and down the hallway. Traveling from room to room, I discovered that every room in my house was in this fashion. Every drawer had been pulled out and overturned. The place was completely trashed. On that day that my wife and I were burglarized, we lost every material thing of value we owned, and I mean everything. TV, VCR, stereo equipment, computer equipment, jewelry that had been handed down to my wife for generations that could never, ever be replaced. On that day that we were burglarized, was I mad? You better believe I was mad. Did I want to get my hands on who had done that to me? I sure did. Did I feel like a victim? Yeah, I did. 2 days later, I'm sitting in my office filling out the insurance forms, and I got to thinking to myself, why did this happen to you, Troy? And then it slowly started to come to me, you see, I had never been on that side. I had always been the thief. I had always been the taker. I never knew what it felt like to be the victim, to be vulnerable, to be taken from. And it slowly started to come to me that maybe I needed to feel that. Maybe I needed to feel what it was like on the other side. Maybe that was the final straw. Maybe that was the final nail in the coffin of the old Troy Evans being buried and put away forever without a chance of him ever returning to who he once was. Faith that things happen in our lives for a reason. And the fourth and final thing I want to share with you I learned over those 7.5 years, it's not important how we come to the events in our life. What's important is how we deal with them. Once I landed in prison, it did not matter how I got there. That did not matter. I couldn't change any of that. We can look at our past. We can learn from it. We can reflect on it. But we never, ever want to dwell on it. And just as importantly, we never want our past to be a hindrance to our future. If you tried to accomplish something in the past and failed, does not mean you cannot accomplish it in the future. When I stood up here and I shared with you my 4.0 and my deans and presidents list, I didn't stand up here to share that with you to brag or boast. I shared that with you to help you understand that if that can be accomplished within the harsh and violent confines of a federal penitentiary, that you can accomplish anything out here in the free world with all the resources that you have at your disposal. It's not important how we come to the events in our lives, but how we deal with those events, how we go from today forward. And just to help drive home that point, I want to tell you a story about two brothers who come from the exact very same event and end up in such totally different places. The story's out of Australia, and it's about two brothers who are caught stealing sheep. In Australia, the penalty for this is fierce. Each brother has the initials ST branded, seared into his forehead, forever labeling him sheep thief, ST. For one brother, the humiliation is overwhelming. Traveling from town to town, he becomes crafty and cruel, yet he can never really escape himself, and after a very short few years, he dies under suspicious circumstances, a very tormented man. For the other brother, he decides he either has to face this crisis or be destroyed by it. He makes a conscious effort to earn back his self-respect. He starts every single day asking himself, what can I do just today to earn back my self-respect? As time passes, people begin to trust him, and his story becomes old, faded print on old, faded newspaper. He becomes a leader of the community, a champion of those who struggle, and an example of courage to the young. Many, many years later, a visitor comes to town, and he's amazed when he sees a little old man shuffling by a storefront with the initials ST branded into his forehead. So he asks the shopkeeper, who's that old guy? What's his story? The shopkeeper says he used to be the mayor here. There was some rumor about how he got those scars, but for the life of me, I can't remember what it was. I think it has to do with him being a saint. It's not important how we come to the events in our life. What's important is how we deal with those events. And what I want to close with now before I open it up for some questions, I want to close with my favorite quote in the world. I love this quote. It's by Martin Luther King Jr. And it's not free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. That's my second favorite. My favorite quote in the world by Martin Luther King Jr. goes like this. I may not be the man I want to be. I may not be the man I ought to be. I may not be the man I could be, and I may not be the man I can be, but thank goodness I'm not the man I once was. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's very generous. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate that. You're very kind. Listen, we've got some time together. I want to open it up for some questions. Please feel free. You can ask me anything at all, what it was like before, during, after, anything at all that comes to your mind that you want to ask me about. Please, we've got some time together, so don't be afraid to speak up. Have I written a book? I have. Actually, my second book was picked up by a major publisher and came out in April of this year. And in fact, they're available here at the conference. They'll be in the bookstore, which I believe is set up just right around the corner here. But yeah, my second book just came out April 1st, came out in hardback edition. And exciting stuff with that. And then I'm going to be on, I'm sorry?
The name of your book.
The name of my book. It's From Desperation to Dedication, : An Ex-Con's Lessons on Turning Failure into Success. My first book was From Desperation to Dedication, Lessons You Can Bank On. And that not only the book coming out, but actually two Saturdays ago, I was at CBS Studios in L.A. shooting a reality show for CBS that's going to be airing sometime this fall. So that, and my agent in L.A. is about to land a movie deal on my life story. And so you guys are going to be seeing me on a much bigger venue here pretty soon. So exciting stuff coming up. So Mel caught me at a good time and convinced me to come here and share my story with you folks. And I was glad the date was open. It was really my pleasure to come here. But he's the man that was responsible for it. So if you like what you heard today, you need to give him a thanks afterwards. Yeah, go ahead, David. What became of my son? Well, he's 22 now. He's got a car and a girlfriend. The old man's not near as important as he used to be. But he's a good kid, and we're very close. You know, when I talked about earlier, you can't do anything about where you're at. All I could do was be the best prison dad I could be. That's all I could do. I didn't have any other choice. I rode him every day for 7.5 years. I never missed one day. Every single day, a piece of mail went out for him. On Mondays, 2 days, two pieces of mail went out. And we talked several times a week on the phone. My family would fly him out several times a year to visit with me. And, you know, I just tried to be the best prison dad I could be. And I think that because of that, he turned out to be the good kid that he is today, in part. But I'm glad you asked about him, because I want to tell you folks about the first time my son Eric and I saw each other when I was released. When I found out I was getting out 5 years early, right? My release date happened to be 13 days before Christmas, so we kept it a secret from Eric that I was getting out early. And my parents quickly made arrangements for him to fly from Iowa out to Phoenix. And this didn't raise any red flags for him, right? He thought he was just coming to do Christmas vacation with Grandma and Grandpa again, like he had been doing every other year for the past 7.5 years. So they made arrangements for him to come out, and my brother, my sister, my mom and dad and I, we all went down to Sky Harbor Airport, and this was, of course, pre-9/11, when everybody was allowed to go to the gates. And my brother and I stayed about four gates back, me on one side of the hallway with a hat and sunglasses on, and my brother on the other side of the hallway videotaping the whole thing. And my parents and my sister went up and greeted Eric as he got off his plane, hugs and kisses, and they started walking our direction. And when they did, I stepped out from the wall and I started walking towards them. And when they got right next to me, I stepped in front of them and I said, "Excuse me, can somebody tell me what time it is, please?" And I could see out of the corner of my eye, my boy's eyes were that big around and his mouth was wide open. And my mom said, "It's 7:30. And I said, "Thank you very much." And I walked around him and I kept going. And I could hear behind me, "That was my daddy." And my dad said, "No, Eric, that's not your dad. You know where your dad's at. Your dad's in prison." He said, "Grandpa, I'm telling you, you go get him right now. That was my dad." And, of course, that's all I could take. I ran back to him, hugs and kissing and crying. But I blew the kid out of the water. It's the first time I've ever known that boy to be speechless. But thanks for asking. I wanted to tell that story. Yes, sir. Go ahead. How old was I when I started messing with drugs, and why did I do it? It was right around 15 years old, and it was peer pressure, period. And it's my belief that that's the number one reason that our young people make the mistakes that they do is wanting to fit in and peer pressure. I was at 15 years old before we made a move. When I was living in Phoenix at 15, I was a star athlete and an honor roll student. I already had major colleges coming to scout me when I would pitch at 15 years old. And during that summer, we made a move from Phoenix to Colorado. And over those 3 months before school started again and the things that were important to me, academics and athletics and all that got started again, I got hooked up with the wrong people in that neighborhood and just started doing the wrong things. Like I said, just a little marijuana use. I didn't think it was any big deal. But by the time school started, it had completely taken over my life. And it was just like somebody turned a light switch on. It was a whole new world to me. And everything that was important to me all of a sudden wasn't important. And it just grabbed a hold of me and it controlled my life for the next 15 years. So that's why I encourage parents to have an open line of communication with your children. Let your children, educate your children about what's out there. Don't let them be educated by the streets or by their peers. Let them know what's out there before they start getting exposed to these kind of things. I encourage you, if you're parents or if you're an aunt or an uncle, the young people that are in your life, let them know that they can come to you with those things, those pressures, those temptations, and not get in any trouble, but know that they can talk through them with you. And that's a relationship I have with my son. He knows he can bring anything, absolutely anything to the table that he's done or he's thinking about doing, and he knows that we'll talk through it. And we have that agreement. He knows he's not going to get in trouble. And because of that, he'll bring anything to me. And believe me, he's brought some things to the table where I've wanted to reach him and grab him by the nap of his neck and drag him across that table. But we have an agreement. If it's something that I can't rationally talk through that I'm so mad about, that we'll put it on a shelf and we'll give it a few days for me to think through it and then we'll revisit it again. But it's so important. The peer pressure is so brutal out there on our young people. They need to have somebody they can turn to make sure they're doing the right things. Yes, sir. What do I think is the key to being able to beat the cycle of addiction? For me personally, I had to be thrown in a cell and have the door locked behind me and just be left to myself. I had to be hit with the biggest stick that was out there. I think the key is, you know, obviously treatment. But for me, I went through three 30-day inpatient treatment programs. That wasn't enough. I'd get right back out and start using 2-3 weeks later. For some people, that works. You know, some of the programs that are out there, you know, NA and AA and some of those things, they work for some people. Unfortunately for me, like I said, I had to be thrown in a cold cell and just detox and get that stuff out of my system. But I think the key is our society recognizing it for what it is and not having such a stigma applied to it and making programs available to the people that want to help themselves. Obviously, you got to want to help yourself. No, until you're ready to do that, other people can't help you. But once you're ready, most people, if they have a minor brush with the law or they start losing their jobs or it starts affecting their livelihood, that's enough to make them want to stop. But other people, they've got to be hit over the head with a bigger stick, and that's what happened to me. And I think the key is wanting to change your life and want to make a difference and be a different person. But it's, you know, is there any kind of magic wand you can wave? No, there's not. But we just got to keep doing what we're doing and making programs available to the people out there that want to utilize them. Yes, sir, go ahead. Right. He asked, when people are released, what are the chances that they can make it in society? again. Unfortunately, the cards are stacked against them. And one of the things that I'm a huge proponent of is bringing education back into our prison systems. Unfortunately, it's all about incarceration and hardly anything about rehabilitation anymore. And don't get me wrong, first and foremost, I broke the laws of our society. And I believe we have the greatest criminal justice system in the world. I deserve to be where I was for that amount of time. But I also know that, and I met a lot of people that never, ever need to see the streets again. I mean, genuine animals that never need to see the streets again. But I also met a lot of genuinely good people who made one mistake. They lost their job, they had a house that was about to be foreclosed on, they had kids to feed, and they introduced somebody to somebody else to make a quick dollar, and next thing you know, they have a 30-year mandatory minimum sentence, and they become institutionalized. And, you know, it's, we all pay a price for that as a society, whether we're a victim of crime, it's just a big revolving door, whether we're a victim of crime, taxes, whatever, we all pay a price for that. And I've seen studies that show that individuals that come out of prison with just a 2-year degree, an associate's degree, their rearrest rate is 10%. Compared to somebody that comes out of there with no schooling at all, their rearrest rate is 60%. I mean, it costs $38,000 a year to house an inmate. It would cost a fraction of that to educate that individual and make them productive members of society again. And I'm just a huge proponent of that we need to get back into doing that again. We all pay the price, whether it's taxes or a victim of crime or knowing somebody who's a victim of crime. It's an ongoing thing that we need to change. And some of these bigger things that are happening in my life are going to free me up. There's some national groups that want me to do some lobbying that want to kind of hold me up as a poster boy type of thing for this is what can happen if we can put education back into prison. So that's some of the things that I'm going to do when some of these other things happen. Yeah. He asked what happened to the warden in Colorado who threw... Yeah, he's going to become a movie star. He asked about that warden in Colorado. You know, in all fairness, if I could see him right... No, I don't know if I'd kiss him on the mouth, but... if I could see him right now, you know, little did he know he was starting a chain of events that was going to get me released 5 years early and discover that there was a discrepancy, something wrong in my sentencing. But, you know, in all fairness to him, it's kind of like the military. If he allowed me to do that, he had to allow the other 2,000 inmates to do that. And he just didn't have the manpower. There were a couple of people in the education department that volunteered their free time. They would take the videotapes and all everything that came into me and take it home and review it and make sure it wasn't escape plans or that it was what it was supposed to be. So he didn't have the manpower to open that up to the entire. So I can see where he was coming from. At the time, it was tunnel vision. All I cared about is getting my degrees, and he was standing in my way. But at the same time, what a great opportunity he would have had to hold me up and say, look, you know, look what can be accomplished, you know, behind these walls. And maybe he could have been a visionary for some of the other wardens. So I think he missed a great opportunity. But I'm not allowed to have any contact with him, but you know, I'm working on a presidential pardon right now, and when that happens, I'll be able to have contact with him and some of my victims and some people that I need to make amends to. If I would have known Bill was going to hand him out on the way out of office like he did, I would have hit him up a few years ago. So now I've got to wait. George W. whoever comes in next. Go ahead, yes, sir. How was my relationship with my parents during this whole cycle? Obviously, very hard on them, but they stuck with me through the whole thing. You know what, one of my greatest regrets is the hell that I put them through during all of this. You know, but like I said earlier, there's nothing I can do about that. All I can do is, you know, be a good son today and be a good example. And, you know, one of the best moments of my life is the first time they ever came to hear me speak, to hear me actually say the things that I had done and acknowledge them and acknowledge my wrongs and all that. It was good for them to hear that. And, you know, they're very obviously very proud of me and what I'm doing right now. But, you know, they did everything they could. They were paying for $30,000 in treatment programs. They tried letting me run free to get it out of my system. They tried the tough love. They tried everything. But when I went into prison, I had literally burned every bridge. I had my mom, my dad, and my sister were about the only ones that had anything to do with me. But over a course of time, people started coming back aboard. I mean, this right here, your mouth can say anything. But it's when you start showing a course of action over time, all of a sudden relatives who I had burned bridges with started hearing, hey, another semester went by and Troy's still straight A's, and birthday cards and Christmas cards and stuff started showing up, and now literally everybody who I had burned a bridge with, I'm back close again with. So, you know, it was just the kind of thing where I had to show through actions that I was a different person. but put my parents through a lot of hard times, but they're my best friends now, and we get along fantastic. Go ahead. Sure. The evolution of coming back, coming out, and how do you succeed? I was very lucky in that not only did I have family support, but I also, the association that funded my schooling while I was incarcerated was the National Speakers Association. And although it was never actually said, it was always kind of implied that I would use my history and my struggles and accomplishments to try to make a difference in the lives of others. And when I was released and went to Phoenix, where most of my family is, I happened to have lunch one day with a guy who'd been a professional speaker for 30 years, Speaker Hall of Fame, had all the awards and accolades that go with being a longtime speaker. And over this lunch, we hit it off. And he needed somebody in his office, and I, of course, needed a job, so I went to work for him. And he taught me the marketing end of this business. And every single week, he would make me go to Rotary Clubs and Lions Clubs and Kiwanis Clubs and speak at their luncheons for free, and he would videotape the whole thing, and we would take the tape back to the office, and we'd watch it together, and he would tear me to shreds and tell me how terrible I was, and then he'd build me back up and make me go do it again the following week. And after 8 months of this, he finally came to me one day, and he said, you're ready to be out on your own. So he kicked me out the door, so I married one of his daughters and took her with me. So he was my father-in-law for a long time, and thank goodness the mentor sessions finally got cut down to family get-togethers and holidays and that kind of thing. But that I was very lucky in that was in place for me. For a lot of people, they come out of there institutionalized, and you know the one thing I tell them is you paid your debt to society. You know, hold your head up high, walk into that HR office, and first thing that needs to come out of your mouth is, "I just got released from prison. I served my time, I paid my debt to society, here's why I'll be the best employee you can ever have. I'm hungry, I'll be as loyal as a dog, I'll come in early, I'll stay late. I just want a chance to be a productive member of society again." And I speak a lot to HR associations, and that's the one thing I tell the HR people: you hold the key to letting these people become productive members of society again. Ask them what they accomplished while they were incarcerated. If they look at you with a blank stare, that means that they played cards and dominoes while they were incarcerated. You don't want those people. But the ones that can list that they took advantage of drug programs, got involved in the chapel, earned their GED, those kind of things, those are the kind of people you want in your company. But, you know, it's they can get so institutionalized. I want to tell you about a guy named John, who had been in about 12 years. This has to be one of the most pitiful things I've ever heard in my life. I was there when he was released, and he had been in for about 12 years, and while he was incarcerated, he became pen pals with this gal and ended up marrying her while he was in prison. When he got released, they had literally dragged him out of the prison. He went kicking and screaming. He didn't want to go. And he went to his wife's residence, and was there about a week, and she gave him a $5 bill and told him to go down to the grocery store and buy a box of cereal. And after about 3 hours, he still hadn't returned. And she went down to the grocery store, and she found him in the cereal aisle. He had literally been there for 3 hours and had picked up every box of cereal on the shelf and set it back down. He couldn't make a decision on what cereal to buy. He had been told what to eat, when to eat, what to do, when to do it for so long, he wasn't even capable of picking out a box of cereal. That's how institutionalized this guy was. So, you know, it's just, if, you know, whether he chose not to take advantage of what may have been available there or there wasn't anything available, he just became this machine that will never be a productive member of society again. That's why I think it's so important we need to have things in place that can help with those things. Yes, sir. My 2 degrees, my first one was just in general studies, and the second was a Bachelor of Science in Social Science. Obviously, when you take science out of the equation, because I couldn't attend labs, there goes engineering and maybe a lot of the other things I would have been interested in. So very limited in what I could earn degrees in, but my next step was going to be my MBA. You can get an MBA by correspondence as well. And actually, that's still one of my goals today. I'm going to go back and continue and get my MBA. There was a guy that I helped in prison that was just recently released. He did exactly that. He went on to get his MBA. And, in fact, he was part of the reality show that was just shot a couple of weeks ago. And you guys will see him on CBS. It'll be announced here pretty soon. The name of the show is Do You Trust Me? But And a pretty unique concept, but great show. You'll see it's going to be advertised on CBS very soon. Anybody else? Go ahead. How do I get through airport security with my props? I'm very, very careful to make sure they're in check luggage. I mean, can you imagine if I tried to go through security with some of this stuff? But even having, making sure it's always in checked luggage, my wife would always tell me, you know what, you better put a business card and some kind of note saying, you know, these are things that I use during my presentation. And I'd tell her, okay, I'll get to it. Well, sure enough, about 2.5 years ago, I was at the airport in Columbia, South Carolina. I had spoken to an association and was waiting on my flight and sitting there reading the USA Today, and a female police officer comes and stands about 10 feet away from me and starts talking on her radio. And I look at her for a second, but then I go back to my paper because they're all over in the airports now, right? I didn't think anything of it. Well, she leaves, and about 2 minutes later, a very, very large African-American police officer comes and stands about 10 feet away from me and starts talking into his radio. And this guy I look at for a couple of minutes only because I'm thinking I would never want a problem with him. He's like 6'5", 330 pounds. But again, I go back to my paper, don't think anything of it. Sure enough, a couple minutes later, here comes a female officer, and she sits down next to me, and she says, excuse me, are you Troy Evans? And the guy next to me starts to get up and leave, and she's like, no. It's okay, sit down. I think we're all right here. She said, listen, TSA found some stuff in your luggage, and I need to hear out of your mouth exactly what those things are. And I went on to tell her, and she said, you know, to be honest with you, I went through both your bags, and I saw your books and DVDs and CDs and all that, and I kind of put two and two together. But I just needed to hear it out of your mouth. But what had happened, it was a female TSA agent that was going through my bag, and the first thing she pulled out was this pork chop bone. And I guess she let out a blood-curdling scream, and they all came running. They were convinced that I was involved in some kind of animal, ritualistic, voodoo type of activity. So needless to say, there's a business card and a note in the bag with these things now. So let that be a lesson. When your mate tells you to do something, do it. Listen, it's quarter after. My time's up. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Troy, thank you for sharing that with us. We have a break now for 15 minutes. If you'll be back in your seats at 10:30. Thank you.